The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Today's podcast is heading into dangerous territory, crossing the line into criminality with a couple of novels which examine what happens to ordinary people when they find themselves on the wrong side of the tracks. Javier Cercas won the Independent Prize for Foreign Fiction in 2004 with his best-selling investigation of the Spanish Civil War, Soldiers of Salamis. In Outlaws, Cercas charts a gradual slide into illegality as the son of a civil servant falls in with a teenage gang, and then how the gangster and his mole come back to haunt him as a successful lawyer 20 years later. Ned Bowman's debut, Boxer Beetle, put Nazis in the ring with East End fighters, while his second novel, The Teleportation Accident, splices together Weimar Berlin and 1930s LA. His third novel, Glow, sets off in pursuit of a mysterious new compound which ignites a ghost conflict between Burmese revolutionaries and a mining corporation on the streets of South London. We find Bowman's bumbling protagonist at 5:37 a.m, exiting an illegal party with little in the way of chemical assistance and without the girl he'd given his own chance at a hit of Glow.
Raff stumbles out of the laundrette to find himself engulfed in flowers. It's as if some phenomenological anode inside him has been swapped with its cathode, so that every sensation is replaced by another of exactly inverse quality and equal intensity. Petals for skin, perfume for sweat, cold for heat, silence for noise, anthocyanins for disco lights. Only after a moment does he realise that on Saturdays there's a flower market on this road, so they're unloading the tulips and daffodils. And sure enough, just at that moment, the silence is broken by the trundling of a steel trolley as it comes down a ramp behind him. He breathes in deeply and then walks on down the road to the bus stop where he can catch his night bus. Isaac and Barky have already left the rave. For a while, they said they weren't feeling anything from the glow, and Barky also had a gram of ethyl bufadrone, so they all resorted to dabbing some on their gums, which always reminds Raff of rubbing salt and pepper into a flank steak. But then straight after that, too soon for it to be the ethyl bufadrone, the other two had run out into the yard and started vomiting ballistically over the concrete. Between spasms, Barky said the glow they'd taken must have been fake. It occurred to Raff that if he hadn't even heard of glow until tonight, and yet some opportunist was already selling a fake version, he must be badly behind the times. And then he realised with horror that somewhere the American girl was probably throwing up too because of drugs he'd pushed on her. And she only had about half Barky's body mass, so a poison could kick her twice as far. Even if he ever found Cherish again, she'd never want to speak to him. Now, coming down from the ethyl bufadrone, Raff just feels bleached and fidgety, and he decides he probably didn't have a chance with her anyway. When the bus finally arrives, its windows are bright like a goods vehicle hauling not flowers to market, but bulk photons. He gets on, nods to the driver, beeps his Oyster card, and climbs the spiral staircase up to the top deck. What he sees there startles him so much that he forgets to hold on to the vertical handrail, so when the bus halts at a junction, he nearly topples forward. A fox sits there, about six rows back. Every hair in its orange coat burns with a separate flame, and the reflection of a streetlight outside the window is curled up inside each of its round black eyes like a pale girl in a spin dryer. Raff has never noticed before that the white fur of a fox's snout and belly is sprinkled over its eyes, too, to make two oversized brows. And as it considers him, this one wears an expression of detached scientific interest. The animal couldn't have got past the driver, he thinks, so it must have jumped on at the exit doors when someone got off. As the bus accelerates again, he sits down, and the fox turns from him to look out of the window. A scent reaches Raff's nose, muddy and petroleous, a savage hydrocarbon with no derivatives. No other passengers get on, and when the automatic loudspeaker announces in her broken diction that they've arrived at Camberwell Green, the fox jumps to the floor and trots downstairs to disembark.
So where did Glow's chemistry begin? What were the reactants in your illegal laboratory?
My first two books were mostly set in the 30s and 40s, and I thought if I'm going to write something about the present day this time, what are the things that I haven't had a chance to write about from the present day that I feel like no one else is writing about. And one of them was pirate radio in London, and the other one was corporate imperialism in the developing world, which I'd been interested in since reading The Shock Doctrine by Naomi Klein several years ago. And as is usually my methods, when I have two disparate ideas, I try and find a way of saving time by just putting them in one book. So I was trying to find a way that those two things could overlap. I thought about drugs, because obviously pirate radio has a lot to do with the rave scene and people are taking a lot of drugs there. And a lot of these countries where the sort of worst, like, corporate human rights abuses are going on are in Southeast Asia, which is the Golden Triangle, which is where a large proportion of the world's drugs, including drugs being taken in Europe, are manufactured. So I realized straight away that it was going to be a drug thriller of some kind.
And it's a proper kind of thriller in some sense, a kind of a crazy thriller, but proper measured out on the watch.
Yeah, it's very plotty. I mean, my first two books took place over several years and decades, indeed. This one basically happens in 3 weeks, and you know what Raph, the main character, is doing for every hour of those 3 weeks. And the plot is meant to be, yeah, pretty relentless. You're always with him. It's quite Hollywood in places. But my reference for thrillers is not so much books, but always Hitchcock films. So I thought of it a little bit like North by Northwest or something, where you stay with the protagonist continuously, and the time scale is extremely tight, and the plot never stops coming in that way.
What are the ingredients for this chemical reaction? You've got a new drug, you've got a shady corporation. What? How do they fit together?
I don't want to give too much away, but there's, yeah, an American mining company called Lacebark, who run a mining concession in Burma, which they run as their sort of fiefdom because they pay a generous royalty to the Burmese government. This is in 2010, before most of the recent kind of democratic loosenings. You have this guy, Raph, who is a kind of everyman in South London. Well, everyman, except that he has this rare condition called non-24-hour sleep-wake syndrome, which affects his circadian rhythms. And he notices kind of pattern of strange things going on. One of them is that his friend has disappeared. One of them is that there's this new drug at raves called Glow, and no one knows where it comes from. One of them is that he sees foxes behaving weirdly and sort of almost intelligently at night. And then the fourth one is that there are these sort of empty warehouses that seem to be springing up around South London that are perfect for raves, but sort of also a bit sinister because you don't know what their purpose is or was. And also he meets this girl, and then it turns out all of these things are connected.
The novel begins with Raph sticking a twist of cigarette paper with something or other that he doesn't know what it is into his mouth. It's kind of this extraordinary experience that's so absolutely ordinary, really, in this age. I mean, was that part of the attraction? You wanted to explore this culture?
Well, yeah, I think there are times when the drug culture is sort of destabilized and times when it settles down again. So it was destabilized, well, not that I was there, but in the 60s, as I understand it. And that was a time when, you know, people would put any tab on their tongue that someone gave them, because it was just impossible to take a sort of organic food approach to the provenance of what someone was selling you. And then I think the, like, mid to late 2000s, as I gather, was another destabilized time, because there was a kind of new wave of legal highs, most famously methadone, which is erroneously called Meow Meow in tabloid headlines, which were had very strange roots around the world. So they were often invented by sort of Israeli or Canadian chemists, and then they were manufactured in China, and then they were retailed by these operations in Essex, and then sold over the internet to sort of people at art schools in South London. I think that was a time when there was so much flooding the marketplace, no one really knew what anything did, that people, again, just sort of gave up trying to get a bead on exactly what they were taking and would just swallow things pretty happily. Although, I don't know, maybe that's always been the case among a certain age group, but it seems like maybe more so when there was this kind of just panoply or phantasmagoria of what is sometimes called research chemicals, because they come out of chemistry labs, and I didn't feel like that had really been written about. So I think there's a Ben Brooks's first book, which I haven't read. I know that it's been described as a methadone novel, but on the whole, I felt like no one had really done anything with that era. And I don't find drug experiences very interesting, or drug writing in the conventional sense, but I am very interested in what drugs do to like people's social lives and their love lives and ways of engagement with the world more widely. So I wanted to write about that.
Another area which has been slightly less explored in literary culture that you deal with in the book is South London. It may be set very much in that particular corner of South East London, but it's also a very global novel. There's the mining in Burma, there's the shady South African security. Is it an angry novel?
I don't think of myself as like an intensely political writer, or even a medium political writer, to be honest. I'm like quite apathetic, I think, in many respects. And also, I don't have the background, I don't think, to write novels which really go for political change. To do that, I think you have to have some first-hand experience of injustice around the world, which, to be honest, I don't. But as I've said, The Shock Doctrine by Naomi Klein was really important to this book. I don't think anyone could read that book. I don't know, you won't necessarily feel angry, but I think you have to feel like something has gone seriously wrong with the way we regard the free market and corporations and what they can be permitted to do and the freedoms that we can give them to operate around the world before we as a society, as it were, have blood on our hands. So I wanted to write about that, and I especially wanted to write about, we're fairly complacent about corporations that are based in the US or in Europe doing things in other countries which would clearly be against the laws of the US or the EU. But because it's other countries, we don't mind so much. And I was thinking, if a company like Blackwater thought they could get away with operating in London like they do in Baghdad, for instance, or like they used to, how would we feel if we found out they were doing that? And if we were outraged that they were behaving like that in London, how can it be that we're not outraged that they're behaving like that in Baghdad? Because in London, if we're in London, we don't have any greater moral rights than people do in Baghdad. So there's this, I think, serious kind of moral disjuncture where we allow, you know, these companies do bad things in foreign countries and they bring the money home, but they don't bring home the burden of moral responsibility, but which ought to be coming home at the same time as the money.
It was part of the fun of writing the book to keep the caper rolling along with a protagonist who's so comically inept.
Well, I wouldn't call Raff inept. I mean, he's a kind of everyman. He's quite brave, as it turns out, but he doesn't have any special skills. Like, he wouldn't be very good in a fight, for instance.
Fitch calls him obviously fucking clueless, and halfway through he talks to the lace bark guy and says, oh, okay, should we just stop it here, lads? You know, we're done here. He's refusing to submit to the genre in which he finds himself.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose Raff is naive in some respects because he's basically a decent guy who's never been confronted with villainy before. And he, you know, a lot of the events in the book, you could say they're implausible. Well, he finds them implausible too. Like, nothing like this has ever happened in London before. So he's not very well prepared to deal with these things. And his first instinct is not to turn into James Bond. His first instinct is to just see if it can be settled. So I suppose that's why. Whereas Full Petal, who is his sort of grudging sidekick, has already worked in this world and knows that it's kind of amoral and knows that no one is going to sit down over a cup of tea and like work things out as mates, as it were. But again, I mentioned Hitchcock. Hitchcock does a lot of sort of wrong man plots where the hero is not a James Bond or a Jason Bourne. The hero could be any of us who gets involved completely by accident in some global plot. And, you know, for the first half of those films, generally is a bit bumbling and a bit naive. And then something happens. And then in the second half, they become a little bit James Bond usually. But, like, I also think Raff develops a lot over these 3 weeks. But yeah, I think it would have been a less interesting book if Raph had started off being very capable in that respect, because the whole point of it is that it's this like kind of world of espionage and like skullduggery colliding with the normality of South London, and part of the normality of South London is Raph himself.
The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code Guardian to take 10% off.
The everyman at the heart of Javier Cercas's outlaws is Ignacio Cañas, who bumps into the charismatic criminal Zarco and the mysterious Tere in an arcade. Here, Cañas discusses with the unnamed author of the book how this ordinary boy fell in with a bunch of teenage hoodlums.
From then on, I started to go to La Font almost every afternoon. But you didn't have to. You'd paid Zarco back the favor in La Mongoda, and you were even. Yeah, but there was Tere. You mean you joined Zarco's gang for Tere? I mean that if it hadn't been for Tere, I almost likely wouldn't have done it. Although I arrived at the conclusion that she wasn't the girl for me, I wanted to think that while we were near to each other, what had happened in the Villaro arcade washrooms could always happen again. And I think I was willing to run any risk in order to keep open some possibility of that happening again. That said, you're a writer and must know that even if we find it very comforting to find an explanation for what we do, the truth is that most of what we do doesn't have any single explanation, supposing that it even has any. To find an explanation for what we do, the truth is that most of what we do doesn't have a single explanation, supposing that it even has any. You told me before that robbing the house was a rush. Does that mean you enjoyed it? It means what it means. What do you want me to say? That I loved it? That the day I stole stuff in La Mongoda I discovered that there was no way back? That Tarko's game was a very serious game where everything was at stake? That I could no longer be satisfied playing the Rocky Balboa pinball machine where I had nothing at stake? You want me to say that playing that game I felt I was getting even with my parents? Or you want me to tell you that I was getting revenge for all my humiliations and the guilt that had been accumulating over the last year, and that as Batista represented absolute evil for me, this game that liberated me from Batista represented absolute guilt? Maybe I've already said it, and it may be true, but do me a favor, don't ask me for explanations, ask me for facts.
So how did you start writing Outlaws?
As I always start, with a question, which is, what if? So all the books begin like that, all the novels, all fictions. And the question in this case was, what if, when I was 16 years old, I wouldn't be, you know, a middle class, normal boy, and one day I cross the border of the city and I get messed with a gang of dangerous people. I must say that at that time in Spain there was a lot of these kind of gangs. So, and what would happen, you know? It's always like that for me, and I guess for all writers.
And so there's this story of a teenager who crosses the tracks, who literally goes to the other side of the city and finds this gangster.
Yeah. It's I would say it's a story of a young guy, 16 years old, that he lives, as I lived, close to the frontier of the city, marked by a river. And one day when he crosses this border, he discovers that the physical border is not just a physical border, but it's a, you know, a moral border, or if you want, a symbolical border between, you know, evil and good. Well, it's a social border also. And also it's the border between being a boy and being a mature man. The first part of the book is a sort of Bildungsroman. So, yeah, it's how a young guy becomes a mature man. I think that in the second part of the book, we discover, or I discover that, or this guy discovers that this story of the maturity is just bullshit. I mean, it doesn't exist, in fact.
Because, I mean, you have the teenager and the gangster that he meets, and the gangster's mole of some sort, or Terry, who he meets as well. But then there's also the second half of the book is set, 20 years later?
Yeah. The first part of the book is that it's a Bildungsroman where this guy discovers the important things, you know, of life, like violence, like death, like sex, like love, these kind of things. You know, just a summer, a terrific summer, a very violent summer. And he thinks that everything has passed. He becomes a lawyer. One thing that is very important for me, that as Follner said, past is not dead. It's not even past, because it's always there. And that's an obsession for me. I think that we live in a sort of present dictatorship. I mean, we think that we can understand present just with present. And that's not true. Because past, it's not something that is there, you know, that has nothing to do with us. It's a part of the present. It's a dimension of the present. And, well, in the second part of the book, this past comes back and shows that it's not dead. But everything has changed, of course, because he's a lawyer and these people have become, well, his life is totally different from him. For me, it's a love story. Something very surprising for me when I began the book, because that was not my idea.
It's built out of transcripts of these supposed interviews with three of the characters in this gangster, El Darko's story. And they're kind of interviews that they give this unnamed writer. Did this structure come up? Did you do interviews to get to the bottom of your account of the 1981 coup? Did this structure come from those, from that process?
No. I arrived to this strange structure, trying to look for the truth, trying that something sounds real.
Why couldn't you just let Cañas tell his own story?
Because it doesn't sound real. It doesn't sound truth. The center of this book, I would say, is the ambiguity, which is not only the center of this book, but I think all literature. You know, ambiguity is the space you give the reader so he can make the book his book. If this space doesn't exist, literature disappears. And the center of this book is ambiguity in the sense that there is no one truth. There is no such thing as the truth. There are conflicting truths. Only the reader can decide what is the truth. This structure is the key for that. We have the one version and then another version and then another version of the same story. So only the reader can decide what is the truth.
But you could have quite easily have had Cañas as a first-person narrator and then the director of the prison as another first-person. Sure. But yet you've got this extra layer of this writer who's in the room taking down the interview, who's the writer who's sometimes conversing with his interview subjects, trying to get them to go down a particular track or going back to something they'd said earlier. Why do you need the extra layer of the writer in the room?
That's good. That's a very good question, because I think that there are not only three narrators in the... Apparently there are three narrators in the book, because they are the three persons that talk. But in fact, the most important character in the book is this guy, because it's he who chooses finally what is the book. At the beginning of the book, he's supposed to write a book on a famous gangster, young gangster of the 1970s, 1780s in Spain. But the book changes while he discovers the story in which he's interested.
And I mean, at the interviews is a way of celebrating that process, of making that process come to life.
Absolutely. I would say that my books are adventures novels on the adventure of writing novels. And so I show always how the book works. And this is a way of showing it. I mean, how this narrator changes his own way of looking at the story he needs to tell. So at the end, the story is totally different. It's not the story of this gang, of this gangster, this important gangster of the 70s, but the story of these three characters, and mainly the story of the love story that is inside these three characters.
You say that there are conflicting versions of the truth, but the truth is, in some sense, what the novel, what all your novels are really about, trying to get at that truth.
Yeah.
It's almost as if it's kind of it's an experiment, a way of examining what might be true. But it's a kind of a trick, isn't it? Because always you're unwilling to provide a truth. You're almost unwilling to admit that there might be a thing that is true.
Yeah, I think that you're right. All my novels work like that. I would say that the novel as a genre works like that. There is a question, and you want to get an answer. And the whole book is a quest for an answer. But at the end, there is no answer. The answer is the quest for the answer. The answer is the same, the book itself, the quest itself. That's
there,
it.
There are writers, 10 to a dozen, who are very happy to provide the answers for you. You're just not interested in that kind of book?
At all. Absolutely no. I mean, I think that literature doesn't work like that. All books, I insist, all books work like that. I mean, El Quijote, which is the best novel I know. At the beginning of the book, we have a question. Is Don Quixote mad or is not? This is the question. And the whole book, 1,000 pages, is looking for a question for that. And at the end of the book, Don Quixote, what is the answer? The answer is that Don Quixote is totally crazy, but at the same time, he's both.
Both at the same time.
Both at the same time. I mean, and what the hell is Moby Dick? Why Ahab is so mad? Why he wants to kill this animal? Is he God? Is he the devil? Is it evil? It's good? But we don't know at the end. I mean, there is no answer, and the answer is the book itself. That's how literature works. There is no clear, inequivocal answer at the end of the book. It's a contradictory, ambiguous, essentially ironic answer. At the end of the book, we don't know what is the question of this book, these outlaws. Who was the person that
betrayed the gang?
Bravo. That betrayed the gang. At the end, we don't know. We have reasons to think one thing or another. And if you decide that, for instance, Terry is the person who betrayed the gang, the book has one sense. If you decide she didn't, the book has another sense. And that's literature. I mean, it works like this. I mean, I love books. I mean, I like books that give the answer, but this is not...
It's a different game.
It's a different game.
There's another added now to the list of Cercas moments. There's the soldier who spares Mazas in Soldiers of Salamis. There's Rodney looking at the children playing frisbee in Speed of Light, and Suarez sitting straight up in his chair as the coup happens around him. But now we've got Cuenca in the bedroom when he's looking at Cañas as a teenager and deciding what to do. And again, we're not quite sure what happens. Is there a moment like that in so many of your books just because it puts you right up against that possibility of a truth?
Well, that's a good question. Also, somebody said that this was the Cercas moment in the book. You're right. I don't know. It's a sort of epiphany. Is it a sort of what Virginia Woolf called moments of being?
But an epiphany is often a moment of change, a moment when somebody realizes something. These are moments when nobody knows.
Yes, exactly. Nobody knows. Because this policeman at the end of the book doesn't know why he did that. I mean, but moments of being in the sense that they are full of meaning. Full of meaning that, again, in some books, I mean, for instance, in The Anatomy of a Moment, this book about the president of the government sitting in his bench at that moment, it's full of meaning. We don't know exactly what is the meaning, but they're full of meaning, personal, moral, historical. I don't know. They're mysterious. That's what I mean, I'm intrigued for this.
Is it so much that there's so much meaning there that we don't know what that meaning could be, or that it's so various we can't grasp it all?
Probably.
That's the moment that really appeals to you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, moments that are not clear, that have no reason, and that at the same time are essential for life. But that's very important. For President Suarez in The Anatomy of a Moment, for the soldier who saves the life of the man or for Rodney in The Speed of Light, or for this policeman who says, well, you know, there are misunderstandings in my life, and these are the most important moments in my life. I don't know why I did that, but I know that this is important. Why I did, I don't know. Again, to quote Follner, literature is like lighting a match in the night. We cannot see anything, but we see the night at least, and that's why. I mean, it's like that. It works like that. At least we know that we are surrounded by night.
Just one more thing. There's a refrain in the book that there's just one more thing. They're coming towards the end of the interview, and he wants just another thing. But is that partly to bring the reader up against the fact of the novel being a series of interviews, or is it actually reaching out towards the idea that the story, the novel, the world itself is never complete?
Well, yeah. There is no absolute truth. The world is not complete. Yeah, because we have versions of reality. We have points of view. Yeah, we see parts of it. It works like that, isn't it? I mean, only God has a perfect view of reality, complete view of reality.
And where's he?
Yeah, but not we. I mean, we human beings are. I mean, we see a tiny part of it, right? And we always look for a revelation. We think, okay, we're gonna see the meaning of things, but we never see that, right? This imminence of a revelation maybe is what we call art, right?
Outlaws by Javier Cercas is published in the UK by Bloomsbury, while Ned Bowman's Glow is published by Scepter. For more border crossing literary discussion, you can follow us on SoundCloud or subscribe on iTunes or find us on the Guardian Books website. Just search for Guardian Books Podcast. From me, Richard Lee, from our producer, Ian Chambers, thanks for listening.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code GUARDIAN to take 10% off.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.